Hi, my name's Edie and I am an alcoholic. I think I need to talk a little bit about my experience of getting here. I think what they're trying to do, the young people speaker, is they want us to work the principles. They gave me the wrong directions to the hotel when I got here last night. They didn't have a room for me. I just didn't realize I have rejection and abandonment issues. But we've worked through it, and I'm here, and I'm scared to death. Linda told me that I got up here and took one step for me, and I took another step for God. And it's really an honor to be here. I have relatives in the audience, and right now at this point, my ass is in convulsion, so you know. But I'm in a dress, I'm fully clothed, and I'm scared. So, you know, they've taught me that if you talk about it, it loses its power. You know, someone else told me that you get dressed and God will do the rest, and so God's going to kick in here any moment. A lot of things happened to me in this city. You know, I was spending the afternoon listening to Terry Bradshaw on channel KQED, right, talking about all sorts of things. And I was born in San Jose, January 31st, 1955. It was a good year for Chevys. I was coming over the hill last night, you know, and I could see the lights. I could see the lights of the city, and the friends that were with me were saying, well, what does it feel like to look at the city to see the lights? And I said, I don't know. It feels real funny. Yeah, it feels like, you know, I'm looking down on the city that I was born. I was born here, suicide here. And I heard my speaker, my sponsor speak here in 1980. So that, you know, I mean, there was just a lot of emotion. What it feels like to be coming home, coming back to a place that I was born to come and talk to you about my life. I'm looking out here at all of you, and my mind says, did you ever drink? Where did you drink? How did you drink? And I had my first drink. I grew up with the kind of people that they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, seeking lower companionship. I didn't grow up in the kind of family that they, you know, they sort of had a Buick Electra and then sort of worked their way down to a beat-up Ford. They were just always in a beat-up Ford. And we were sort of always sort of living in the beat-up Ford. So when I was younger, I had a goal in life. I had three goals. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, I didn't want to be a whore, and I didn't want to live in a Ford. So you can tell that I come from goal-oriented type people. I always just knew that I was from the wrong side of the track. So I don't know about anybody else, but growing up in my childhood, I spent a lot of times in old beat-up cars behind sort of old beat-up bars. And the first drink that I ever had, I remember to this day. And I think I remember it because I am one of the true, true alcoholics. You know, and I think if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting here this evening, and, you know, when I share with you and if you relate to it, it's because you're just like me, you know, and isn't it wonderful that we get to be here together? I want to welcome the new people. And, you know, I don't know who you are, but, you know, I'm so glad that you're here. The first drink that I ever had was out of a bottle of Sigram 7. I pulled out from underneath the seat of that old beat-up Ford. You know that Sigram 7 is that brown flat bottle with that beautiful label. And, you know, you learn how to mimic the people that you live with and that you grow up with. And, you know, they used to reach down between that old seat and they'd pull out that bottle and they'd crank off the top and they'd kick it back. And they'd take a big swig and they'd hand it to the next one. They'd take a big old swig and hand it to the next one and then put the lid back on, put it back under the seat. I seen them do it 100 times. So I don't know, I'm out there. You know, they always say, well, we're going to go in here and have a quick one. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. 3 hours later, they show up with a Coke and a bag of peanuts. Pretty soon, we're going to be leaving here. Yeah. So, you know, I reached under the seat and I pulled that old bottle of Sigram 7 out and I kicked it back, you know, and it went down my, you know, it filled up my mouth and it ran out of my mouth and it came out of my tear ducts and out of my nose and it felt like it came out of my ears. And it sucked the wind right out of me and I could feel it burn all the way down because, see, I hadn't had my Coke and peanuts yet. It was kind of on an empty stomach. So, and it's like that feeling that I, you know, only an alcoholic would understand. It was like it got all the way down inside there and the magic happened. You know, the magic happened. I was 9 years old and I was full of hate and I was angry. And I was angry that I was in that car. And I was angry that I lived with people. And that I hated going to school because I didn't have the right clothes. And I hated going to school because I didn't know what they were doing. I don't know about anybody else, but when you grow up in an alcoholic environment, you know, I could give a shit about the capital of Venezuela. How about the rest of you? You know, I mean, I had shit happening at home. I don't know about anybody else, but I never, you know, it was like I'd show up there and it was like I was either tired because they spent all night beating each other or I don't know. It was just I wasn't real present. You know, I really wasn't there. So, you know, by the time I was 9 years old, I was full of hate. And it's like the magic happened for me. You know, and the thing that I'd like to be able to tell you is that when alcohol and the other things quit working for me, that I came to you, and that's not the truth. That's not the truth. You know, I was, I always drank alcoholically. I graduated from the eighth grade and drank a gallon and a half of Spinata. You know, it was just the way it worked for me, and that's the way it went. You know, I had to do anything I could to quiet the madness and quiet the pain. You know, I grew up in Oakland and San Francisco and Alameda. As a kid, I panhandled on the streets, and the best thing that ever happened to me was Haight-Ashbury. I don't know if there's any. I'm 35, so I don't know. Did anybody remember Haight-Ashbury? Say yes. Yes, we remember Haight-Ashbury. We want group involvement here. I used to sell Haight-Ashbury news. I got it. You need it. You buy it. You read it. Only a dime. It's the best scam I ever had going, you know. But, you know, I was like 12 years old, and I didn't know anything about the Vietnam War. I didn't know anything about free love. I just knew all these people from Kansas and Nebraska came there and wore flowers in their ears and wear petulia oil and bells and stuff. And people used to come through Haight-Ashbury like bumper to bumper wanting to know what was going on. And I, like, had this newspaper, right, that some old hippie printed up. I only had to give him a dime. So these people would, like, say, like, what's going on and where's your mom? I'd say, well, I don't know. She may be in jail at some point. I don't know where she's at, you know. And they'd always give me a dollar. So what I'd do is I'd take all that money I'd make selling that newspaper and I'd go down and buy old donuts and feed the hippies from Kansas that came to San Francisco. Why am I telling you this? I have no idea. Well, I want you to know that I'm not a circuit speaker and I don't have a canned pitch, so there's no telling what I may tell you this evening. Afternoon. yeah, we'll drink to that. I'll let you know that when I do sit down from here, you will know about me. You will know about me. You may know more than I want you to know about me. I graduated from high school and, I couldn't spell, I couldn't type, and I didn't read real well, so I became a carpenter. What's a girl gonna do? I don't know, you know, looking back at that, I think that maybe I did that just so I could prove, you know, I had this thing about wanting to prove that I could be something. You know, I was 10 years old, and actually, I think it was in this town in San Jose that we were in a holding home and a social worker, I was sitting there with my little brother and a social worker said to another social worker, isn't it too bad that she's going to be just like Mary? You know, Mary was a cousin that I lived with after my mother committed suicide. My family was ashamed of the fact that my mother committed suicide, and my father. My family, I think the best I can get out of it is my mother was Mexican and Indian, and she married a white man. And they always had stuff about that. And when my mother committed suicide, being Catholics, they didn't believe that she did, and they accused my father. It wasn't until I was around 33 years old that I absolutely knew that my father didn't kill my mother. You know, because I believed that lie for a long time. It feels really wonderful to stand before you because, see, my mother never made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that my mother was an alcoholic. And, you know, there are people that are sitting right here in front of me, that friends, the people that were with me when I was newly sober, that told me, you know, some of us, that's the only way we can quiet the madness. And that was her way out. And so to be able to stand here tonight, today, this afternoon, it seems like it's nighttime because all the lights, isn't that what it's really hard for me to even believe that my life has come this far. You know, that day that lady said that, I looked at her and I said, no, that's not true. You know, when I was growing up and I was in all those holding homes and I was in those foster homes, never once did anybody say to me, you don't have to live like that. You don't have to be like that. It could be different for you. You know, I had a child psychologist tell me one time that I would spend my adult life incarcerated in prison because I had the inability to adapt and that I was angry. Real smart guy. You know, when I did get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was real angry. And you know, what I've learned since I've been here and by the people in the fellowship, I wasn't as angry as I was just hurt. And I didn't know how to tell people that I was hurt. And, you know, I drank and used for a long, long time. You know, and talk about a bad attitude. I had a bad attitude. You know, there's a story that I tell when I was a little kid. I used to have this bad habit of scraping gum off the ground and chewing it. And don't ask me why. Probably because somebody told me not to. And one day I was, you know, I was over in the projects. We were out in the Fillmore district and living in those, you know, prestigious low-income housing. And it's one of those kind of things where, you know, everybody knows everybody else. And I had a nickel and I had this big old wad of really good gum. You know, it hadn't been chewed all the way. It had some life in it. And, this big fat lady starts walking towards me. And you know, when you live in an environment like that, you know who belongs there and you know who doesn't belong there. And that woman, she started walking closer. And the closer she got, I could hear her nylons. You know, she comes up to me and she says, little girl, why don't you take that nickel and go buy yourself some gum? And I looked up at her and I said, because I want to chew this gum. That's why. So now, do you think I had any problems with the steps when I got here? Yeah, we had some problems with the steps. We have some problems with surrender. You betcha. And that's the way I lived my life. You know, I came here, and you know, it was like, you know, I just would never let anybody do anything for me. You know, the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever went to, my little brother, I took him, he got out of the VA hospital, and he said, Edie, they won't let me go to AA because I'm on antabuse, and I have to have a blood member take me there because they won't let me in. Now, I never heard anything about AA, and I thought, well, I should take him, he's a mess. So I took him to this meeting, and they had a little sign-up sheet, you know, So I signed, I noticed everybody was just saying John C. or whatever. And I thought, well, growing up in welfare and the way I did all my life, I thought, well, welfare paid for the coffee. And how many people were on the list was how much money they got for the coffee. So, I mean, I'm wet-brained. I mean, what do I know? I just know how to live in the system. And so I signed my name. But I didn't sign my name like you guys signed your name because, see, I was an alcoholic. I signed my name Edith Frances Cartwright. Because I didn't want to be identified as an alcoholic. And so some, you know, and I don't know if anybody else is really new, but you know what I mean? They rambled to get to me. It only took me 2 days to figure out what in the dark. What are you going to, you know, let's just strike up some dull conversation here. He says, yeah, Edie, we got a beer. We bought some beer in Sacramento. Oh, Sacramento. That's about 3 hours from where I live. How long have we been at this? So he says, yeah, Edie, we're going to Reno. Reno. What are we going to do in Reno? Oh, we're going to go up there and have some fun. I thought, I think I should go with them and have some fun. They don't look like they would disagree. They wouldn't want me to disagree with that. So I didn't, but you know, I've been to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that they talk about the yes, and they start talking about, you know, so I had been to enough AA that I started hearing that stuff. And I had this little piece of paper crumbled up, kind of folded up, and I pulled it out, and it was a number of one of those women that kept telling me about treatment. Edie, treatment. That's the clue. Treatment. So I called her up and I said, hey, this is Edie. You know that you keep telling me about treatment. I'm at this friend's house, and if you can get here in half an hour, I'll go to treatment. See, I thought treatment was just this big, fancy, white-pillared hospital somewhere where they just took new people and put them in there, you know. And she must have made it. I don't remember. She picked me up. I guess she picked me up. I went into a blackout again, and I don't remember. I came out of the blackout, and I was in Modesto, California, in a detox ward in a place called Reality. Yes, it was a spiritual experience. I was sitting on an old torn-up couch. There was a TV. It was sort of a low-income recovery facility. I was sitting on an old couch. It had all the sponge pulled out of it. I had on Stanislaus County pajamas, stamped all over it with a green robe. But the thing I was most enthused about was the sponge slippers I had wrapped around my feet. So I look at this guy that's sitting next to me on this couch, and I said, so, where are we? He says, we're in detox. And I don't know about you, but my mind said, I think my Blue Shield can get me better facilities than this. Not that I'm a grandiose alcoholic or anything. I want you to know, for the new people, the last drunk I had no Blue Shield. But I had Blue Shield that day. So I kind of mosey on in after I play with my sponge slippers a while. I thought how neat these things are. You can wear them on your feet, take them off, scrub with them, put them back on. You know, you have to realize that I've been on a blackout drunk for 4 or 5 days. I wasn't really hitting on all my cylinders. So I walk into this guy and say, you know what? I think there's been a mistake. I'm almost clear there's been a mistake. He says, how is that? His name was Hank. This man saved my life, you know. He's a black saxophone player, and he'd been there and back, you know. And he said, why don't you have a seat and explain this to me? So I sat right down, crossed my legs, and said, say, you know, I've got Blue Shields, and, you know, I have insurance. Oh, you have insurance. How nice for you have insurance. Some people aren't so fortunate, he says. That's good. Now we can charge you. This whole thing won't... So I run Hank. You know, I told Hank my tale of woe about how, well, you know, I've got a job. My life isn't that bad, and I think that maybe I've had a bad run of luck, and blah, 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 blah. You know, you've heard it. And he looked at me, and he said, honey, you know, it's really sad. I see your type all the time. You know, you're one of those nickel slick kids. You have such an investment in going out and dying. He says, I can give you your clothes, and you can leave here, but you're going to be one of the ones that dies. Because you have the inability to allow anybody in. So what I need to tell you is, if you really want a chance at this life, because you're going to die, what you need to do is you need to go in and you need to get on your knees and you need to ask God to help you, because you're one of the ones that really needs a lot of help. And I don't know why it was any different that day, but I stayed. And I went and got a towel, because God knows I didn't want anybody to see me pray, show some sort of weakness. And I went and got on, went in the shower, and I got on my knees, and I asked God to help me. Because I knew, you know, it's sort of like we intuitively know that it's whipping us. You know, I mean, I was beat up. I was tired. And they said, Edie, why don't you stay with us here and go through our treatment? You know, reality was 28 days. 28 days of reality. I don't know if I can handle it or not, you know. So I said, okay, I think I can do that, you know. And after 48 days, they said, Edie, you got to go now. I don't know about anybody else, but God damn, you know, you get in from that. You know, it takes a lot of work to stay loaded. It takes a lot of work to stay drunk. You know, all that lying, cheating, stealing, and all the stuff that we've got to do just wore me out. You know, I would have stayed, I'd still be there mopping floors. They would just let me stay. Please just let me stay. Don't let me go back out into that world. But I did. And I didn't do so good when I went back out there. You know, I lasted about 30 days and I started drinking, and then I go to the meetings, and I would, you know, it was in Modesto, and you know, and it wasn't too long before I ended up here in San Jose, you know, and that's when I started collecting those 60, 80, 90 days. No, those, no, they don't have 80, do they? They ought to have 80. Don't you think they ought to have 80? It's even. And I heard a woman by the name of Grady O'Hara speak, you know, and I thought, you know what? If I could get that lady to sponsor me, I bet I could do this thing. And I didn't know that it showed a lot of willingness that I move all the way to Sacramento so that she could sponsor me. See, I just wanted to live. I just wanted to live. So I moved to Sacramento. I remember Ben, at the time, Ben, I guess her name was Grady Wilson at that time. She used to be married to Ben. Ben's sitting right over here. And, you know, I don't know, I was like, you know, I was telling Ben, well, I'm going to come, but, you know, I've got this job, and I have to have $1,000 in order to leave, and I've got to, and I was telling Ben all these things that I had to do so that I could come to Sacramento. And he looked at me, and he said in his English accent, obviously, you've never done a thorough third step. And I looked at him, and I looked at the Lincoln Continental that was telling us our approximate time of arrival. And I said, you know, if I had a Lincoln Continental, I'd probably trust in God, too. He says, why don't you just surrender to the program and come on up here and give this thing a real try, you know? And he said all kinds of things to me, and I believed half of it, and I thought half of it sounded crazy, you know? But, you know, I went back to Modesto, and I loaded up my little car, and I came to Sacramento, and... you know, I was downtown, and I was looking for a place to live, and I ran into this man, and this man said, you looking for a place to live? Because I was asking for directions, and I said, yeah, and he said, well, why don't you go over here? I got a little place over there, and why don't you take a look at it, and maybe you might like it. I went over and took a look, and it was just perfect, you know, and I came back to him, and he said, you want it, you can have it for $150 a month. And I'm thinking, oh, is that like God working in my life? Oh, is that like how God works in your life, you know? I remember how I was at a conference, at a Spring Fling conference, you know, and I had like 30 days. 30 days? What am I talking about? 30 days. 30 minutes sober or something, you know? I mean, I was in the back row. My aunt loaded me up, and she took me to this AA conference. And it was the first time that I ever believed what, you know, the speaker was up there talking. I'm sitting in the back. You got to have a picture of this. I got on jeans, a flannel shirt. I got on these, you know, sunglasses. You know, I'm terminally cool. I'm just there because my aunt brought me there. You know, and I used to have this attitude, 2 6-packs of beer and you know what I mean? I didn't say it. They told me I couldn't say the F word, so I didn't. Did you get the effect? It just doesn't work. But... But that day I was sitting in the back of that conference, and there was a woman speaking, and she was talking about being from Downey, California, and she was hearing, and you know, you gotta get a picture of this. I'm in the very back, and I'm all slumped down, and I'm acting real cool, and you know, it's how God kind of slips in there. And she said that she came home from school, and they were bringing food from the church, charity, and she talked about taking that food and throwing it out the front door because starving to death wasn't half as bad as letting anybody know. And I don't know why, but I started to cry. You know, it was like, yeah, I just didn't want anybody to know. I didn't want anybody to know that I hurt. That life was just too painful. And the thought of coming to AA meetings and working the steps, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I hurt so bad, I used to have to get loaded just to be in the room with you because I had such a lack of trust. Just to be with you, I had to be loaded. And that's, you know, my sobriety date is 7/11/1983. And I've been at this since 1980. And it was like, it took a lot for me. You know, my last drunk, I was in the medical center and they had IVs in my arms and they had hoses up my nose and they weren't treating me very nice either. You know? And I didn't have Blue Shield. I had a number. And, well, I must be a mess. Oh, who cares? I looked good when I stood up here in the beginning. Thanks. You know, thank you. You know, I want to tell this story for the new people because I think it's the best story I have ever heard about denial. Since it was my own denial, I will personally share it with you. You know, the doctor, they had stabilized me. I don't know, I went into some sort of convulsions. And I mean, I don't know what it was, but I was pretty sick and I was like almost going to die, you know. And they had stabilized me and they had me all hooked up to these machines and they were doing, you know, they had stabilized me and the doctor came in and my best friend was there and they were all standing around me and the doctor looked at me and said, "So Edie, what happened?" I looked him right in the eye and I said, "Must have been a bad batch of potato salad." You know how that mayonnaise is, you let it sit out. I think I have food poisoning. And, you know, my best friend started nutting out. No, no, she started screaming. She's an addict alcoholic, and she's been drinking, and, oh, my God, she just started to have a fit. And I said, "Yeah, that's true, that's true." And so he says to me, "Are you allergic to anything?" I said, "Just don't give me anything I might want more of." So that was my last drunk, you know, and, you know, then you go back to AA and you're really going to do it this time. It's going to be, this time's going to be it, you know, and, but I always had this thing about God, you know, what about this God thing? God, I had a hard time with God. You know, I used to listen to Ben talk about God, Gwen and Bob and Ben and everybody talk about God. God's in your life, you know, your life is in perfect order. And I'm like, my life doesn't feel like in perfect order to me. Feels like, ugh. Feels awful. So here I am, you know, 17 days sober with a bad attitude. Real bad attitude. My best friend says, "Hey, Edie, we don't have any money for rent." I said, "I know." She goes, "How about we go wash windows?" Wash windows? I'm not going to wash windows. I'm a craftsman. I'm a journeyman carpenter. I can't do such things. But we took these flyers and we went to the most high dollar neighborhood we can find in Sacramento out on the river, you know, those big fancy high dollar homes, and we passed out these flyers and this old lady, she calls me. She goes, "So how much you charge to do windows?" I said, "I don't know. How about $55? Yeah, I thought it was pretty funny too. You wait until I tell you about the house. She says, "That sounds like a good deal. How about you start tomorrow?" I said, "Okay." So we show up. You know, you have to get a visual picture of this house. It's about 6,000 square feet. They've got 3-foot overhangs. If you know anything about construction, 3-foot overhangs are the wealthiest homes. Every bedroom had French doors with a little credenza off of them. All French windows. All wood French windows. Took us 2 weeks to do the windows in this house. But there's a Mercedes in the driveway. There's a little walkway and there's a big fountain. You know, you go through this gate and my mind is saying to me with the 17 days clean and sober, "Boy, if you had this, your life would be okay. You could even drink if you had a life like this. You had that Mercedes. Your life would be perfect if you had this. This is what you need." So I went in there with my bad attitude, and I stepped down on that plush carpet in that living room, and I'm in there with my newspaper and vinegar. High-dollar equipment we had. And I'm in there scrubbing those windows, you know, and in walked this little old lady that had hired us. And she started talking to me. And she says, you know, I can't have diet sodas anymore. I said, I know. I can't ever have a beer ever, ever, ever. Ever, ever again. And she goes, oh, that's awful. And I said, I know. And then she started talking to me a little more, and she said, you know, I live in this great big house, and my children only come to see me when they want money. And I'm so glad that you're here today. It's nice to have company. And it was like what I heard with all those old-time AAers saying, you're exactly where God wants you to be. You're exactly where God wants you to be. And it was the first time that I knew that I was where God wanted me to be. Because she had all those things. And she was just as lonely in her as I was. And it was the first time I ever had that feeling that God was working in my life. And I want you to know, from that day to this day, I've never used anything. And I've had a lot of those kind of days. You know, I thank God for the old-time sober people in my life that have been at it a while, that have taught me things like, your anxiety level is a distance between you and your God. And that have taught me to believe in myself. And they taught me that I could have anything that I wanted because I've been given the keys to the kingdom. You know, when you're new, they tell you those things and you don't believe it, but you just keep showing up, you know. That after that last drunk, I came back and I gave it everything I had, you know. In my home group, there are people sitting right here in my home group, you know. When I asked Grady to be my sponsor, you know, she put her foot up on a chair and she looks down at me and she says, so how much time you got sober? I looked up at her and said, 6 months. Even number. No. Did I know anything about telling the truth when I got here? Am I a liar, a cheat, and a thief? You bet. 6 months. Well, you know what happens in 6 months? It makes 12. They give you a cake. They want to give you a cake and celebrate. And I stood in front of my home group, primary purpose, in Sacramento, and I took a birthday cake with a year. And I wanted so bad to tell them that I had lied. But it was the first time that I'd ever let people into my life. It was the first time that I'd ever let people into my life. And I took that cake, and I lied about my sobriety. And I'm not proud of that, but I want you to know that that's what was necessary for me to be here with you today. And I don't know what God's big plan is, but I know that I got people calling me from Wyoming telling me that they're lying about their sobriety. God works funny ways, you know. And see, what I've been taught is whatever happens to me, I talk about it. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Ben was the one that taught me. Ben, he was my mentor. He taught me everything. Him. He didn't teach me anything, not everything, but a few, you know, between him and God and the rest of them. Ben just got a big loud mouth, and I just heard him louder. And he said one time, I'll never forget it, I was in a meeting, and he said, you know, and I was out there, and I was like a little AA muffin new, and oh, God, you know, God, I was just so glad to be here. And Ben said, you know, a lot of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they get real, real good. And what happens to me when I come here and I get real, real good is I start lying to you. Because, you know, I got all this time in the program and there's somebody new out there and what I want to do is sound real good so you don't think that this thing's so bad, so you'll stay here. So when I get real, real good, I lie. And then what happens is I realize that I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get good. I came here to get well. And in the process of getting well, sometimes I just don't look so damn good. You know? And it's like, God, so that gave me permission to be who I am with you always. See, that gave me permission to tell you the truth about my life, even when it looks bad. I don't want to be good and look good because I've tried it, and the truth is that it hurts. You know, life hurts. And I mean, some days it's real, real good, and some days it's real, real bad. You just don't drink, and you just don't use, and you just keep coming back. And that's what I've learned how to do. You know, I was 3 years sober, and I was self-employed. I said I was self-employed. The truth is I was unemployable. I had a problem with showing up. I don't know anybody else, but that showing up shit just killed me. I mean, they want you there at 8, and they want you to stay, and they want you to, like, work. God, what a concept. So I had this friend in AA, and she was a highfalutin architect, you know, and by this time I'd managed to get my contractor's license, and, of course, I'm self-employed tile setter, hardly making a living, cheating on my taxes, not reporting income. I don't know, probably nobody's ever done that out there. But she says, Edie, you know, they're hiring building inspectors for the state. Why don't you go down and apply? You got to take a test. You know, this part of me that's in recovery that believes that I have the keys of the kingdom, that I do, that I am intelligent, that I'm not that little half-breed Mexican that came to you, wounded, shut down, full of hate, right, that I can do anything. So part of my mind said, well, I think that's a good idea. Why don't you go take the test? And the other part of me says, oh, you're a piece of shit. You're never going to be anything. Why don't you just stay doing what you're doing? Because, you know, the truth is you don't know nothing anyhow. You just fooled them all this time. So you know what I've learned in AA? It's like, yeah, thanks for sharing, and I showed up anyhow. And I took that test, me and 700 men. One guy asked me if I was taking the test for my dad. I said, yeah, he's home drunk. You know, somebody's got to do it. And, you know, I took the test, and it felt pretty good, but I was still afraid because there was lots of questions. You know, it was like they allowed you 7 hours, and I finished in 5. And I thought that was because I just, half of it I didn't know. And you know what happened is I got 85% on that test, and I was hired by the state of California as the first female building inspector on the industrial work. You know, so that part of me said, you know, they talk about the promises, you know, and you work with the people I sponsor, you know, the people you sponsor, you're always telling them that, you know, you're a child of God and God wants only the best for you. But, you know, I forget that, you know, and it was like I went to work for the state, and it was down in Southern California, and the truth is I'm sort of a country gal, and I'm dark-skinned anyhow, and I just didn't like hanging out on the beaches, you know, and I wanted to go back home. And I came home on my 5-year birthday, and there was an ad in the paper for a job at the University of California, Davis. You know, and it was an inspector planner estimator. God, you know, I looked at that and I thought, wow, that would be such a nice job to have. But then my mind says, well, you can't do that. Nope, you could never do that. And then that other part of me that talks about in the book is like, oh, yes, I can. I've been given the keys of the kingdom. I can do anything I want. So I applied for the job, and I got an interview, and I showed up at the University of California at Davis, you know. I need to say it like that because I'm like this. You know, I'm just like, the truth is that I get torn between, you know, the woman I'm becoming and the possibilities, and I get so excited about who I could be and who I have become. But I get so torn with that little wounded kid that just didn't think I'd ever be anything, and the way I got thrown around and the way I got given away and all those things. And I don't know about the rest of you, but it's been kind of hard for me to overcome all that stuff. Just a bit. So I show up there at the personnel department, and they handed me a job description that was 4 pages long, and I took it outside, and I read it, and my mind says, boy, have you really messed up here. My God, they really want, you have responsibility. My God, your budget's $2 million. My God, you can't even balance your own checkbook. What the hell are you doing here? So I did what I was taught. I looked up and I winked at God and I said, how about we go in and give them the very best that we know how to do? We'll just give them the best Edie that we've got today. She's clean and sober and she's going to go in there and give them the best. You know, I went in there and there was an interviewing panel of 5 people. And I want you to know that when I left that room, I absolutely knew that I had that job. I went to my group and I took my 5-year chip and I said, I'm coming home. And they said, do you know if you got the job? And I said, yeah, that God part of me says I've got that job. And they called me the next day and said, we'd love to have you come and work for us at the university. Now, if you're new and you think that I'm bragging, you're right, I am. Because the truth is that I got to you, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was broken in every way you could be. Emotionally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. My heart was encased in lead, and I didn't let anybody know anything. And they wouldn't give me the keys to the porty pot when I got here. And all they kept telling me is, why don't you go to treatment? And it's like, you know, to be able to stand before you, yeah, the promises are coming true in my life. And I have a job today that is wonderful. And the truth is when I got here, I could hardly read and write because of the damage the alcohol had done to me. So I am a miracle. But I absolutely know that the essence of my life is my sobriety. And that without it, I have nothing. And the gifts that have been given to me are unbelievable. You know, most of my relatives, the relatives, my aunts, my mother, they're in San Juan Bautista. They're buried in San Juan Bautista. And one year when I was going to Monterey, I stopped there to visit their graves. And I thought how lucky I am to be able to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and be sober. I have been given my life. My life has been given to me, and my life is good. You know, I have people sitting right down in front of me that absolutely love me. And I can feel it today. Because when I got to you, I could feel nothing. And I would like to, you know, what would I like to do now? I'm a mess. What would I like to do now? Well, I'd like to tell you goodbye. How do we do that? You know what I would really like to do is I'd like to have everybody, let's all hold hands. Can we all hold hands? Let's do it. This is going to be wonderful. Are we all holding hands? Okay. How many people that are holding each other's hands have ever lost somebody and wanted to drink? Will you squeeze that person's hand next to you? Yeah. How many people just knew that they couldn't get through another day without drinking and made it? Squeeze that person's hand. I want you to know that if you're new and if you're old, the gift of sobriety is in your hand. We got each other. Let's go have a good time, huh? Thanks.